verses 13 through 17. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. Yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that. But as it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Therefore, to one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin.
Was a 18th century Scottish writer and historian, and he was married to a woman by the name of Jane Welsh. She was probably every bit as famous as he was, and they had a very rocky marriage, very uneasy marriage, although people who have studied them have said that they both actually did like each other. They both did apparently have some affection for each other. It's just that they constantly argued and fought and that sort of thing, but anyway, the last few years of her life, she was ill and was bedfast most of that time. When she died, it really devastated him. He had a hard time adjusting to it. She died in 1866, and the day that she was buried was a very rainy, sloppy day. After the funeral was over, he went back to his house, went up to her bedroom. He sat down beside her bed and noticed there was a diary on the table beside her bed. She kept a diary for many years. And so he just picked it up and started flipping through it. He found an entry that said, yesterday, he spent an hour with me, and it was like being in heaven. I love him so. And he turned the page, and it nearly broke his heart when he said, I have listened all day to hear his steps in the hall, but now it is late, and I guess he won't come. Little did he realize that in spite of all the rough spots in their marriage, that she really did love him and very much cherished the time that they spent together. Unfortunately for their marriage, he was a very busy man. He was a very prolific writer and spent most of his days writing and just didn't have a whole lot of time to stop and visit with her. As soon as he read that second page, he threw the diary to the floor and rushed back out to the cemetery in the pouring rain. And his friends found him much later laying on top of the muddy pile where her grave had been dug. They kept crying out over and over, if only I had known, if only I had known. He was weeping, he was grieving for lost opportunity. I have three words on my title. You ever said any of those? I could have done that. Well, what's that TV ad? I could have had a V8, although I don't know why anyone would regret not having a V8. But anyway, I could have had that. I could have done that. You ever said, I should have done that? And have you ever said, I would have done that, but? And usually after each one of these, there is the word but. It all represents lost or past opportunities, opportunities to do something, and we passed on those opportunities. Paul said in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 15, he said, therefore, be careful how you walk, not as unwise men, but as wise, making the most of the opportunity, for the days are evil. Some of the older versions say, instead of saying making the most of the opportunity, they say redeeming the time. If only we could redeem time. The idea of redemption is to buy back something. Time is one of those things that once it is spent, and opportunity is the same way. Once they are spent, once they are passed, there is no way to get them back. So what we have to do is make sure ahead of time that we don't forfeit those opportunities to do what's right. So what I want to do tonight is talk about some examples of missed opportunities and how we can correct them when they come our way. Well, again, just by looking at the text that was read just a few moments ago by Rusty, James chapter 4, I can't think of very many passages in the Bible that treat the subject better than James 4. James, at the end of this chapter, just introduces his subject by saying, come now, you who say today or tomorrow, we will go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. He's addressing people who are very, very busy and who simply take things for granted. My my title there says, he's talking about presumptuous living. Just the idea that you constantly presume on tomorrow. You live as if there is an unlimited number of tomorrows, and James' point is you don't have that luxury. First thing he talks about is our very busy lives in verse 13. I don't know about you, but verse 13 doesn't sound all that ancient to me. That text was written 2,000 years ago, but it has an awfully modern ring to it, doesn't it? It has an awfully contemporary feel. Today, tomorrow, we'll go to this place or that place. We'll do such and such a thing. We'll engage in this kind of business. We'll make money. How many of you have organizers and have dates set for days to come, weeks to come, months to come? I know a lot of people have told me that with their jobs, they have to set their, they have to request or set dates on vacations 6 months, 9 months, a year ahead of time. We have to think that far ahead of time so often in our modern busy lives. Very often our calendars are just crowded to the nth degree. It's like we have no breathing room whatsoever. Sometimes finding time to do much of anything becomes a problem. And it is very much an issue in our day, and James informs us that it was an issue in his day as well. It's hard for me to believe that people who didn't have computers, who didn't have cell phones, who didn't have cars and airplanes, and who didn't have all the modern technology that we have, it's hard for me to think, well, how could they have been that busy? But James says it's a very old problem. We very often crowd our schedules with too many things that don't necessarily need to be done. He also talks about our life being uncertain in the next verse. Verse 14, he says, yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. I understand, and I think James understood too, the necessity of making plans. James is not against making plans. He's against the kind of presumptuousness that sometimes goes into it. All of us do have to make plans. My guess is everyone at some point tonight before you go to bed, you'll set your alarm clock in anticipation of getting up at a certain time. And you will already assume that, well, tomorrow I've got this, this, and this. You know, I was talking to Kevin Collins last night, and the assumption is that Monday morning sometime, or sometime Monday, there's going to be surgery up in Minneapolis on Alexander. And we proceed on assumptions like that all the time. There's nothing wrong with making them. Prudence suggests that we do make plans ahead. But we always need to do it with the understanding that there are no guarantees about tomorrow. There are no guarantees that tomorrow will come. The Lord may decide to visit us tonight, and his second coming may occur before tomorrow ever dawns. Or even if he doesn't return and visit the world, each individual may pass in the night. We don't really know what tomorrow brings. And so he says, you don't know what your life is like. You're just like a vapor that appears and then vanishes. The vapor that he is thinking about there, think about a boiling pot of water. Those little wisps of steam come up from the pot, and before they hit the ceiling, they disappear. Or if you blow out a candle, that little wisp of smoke lingers for a few moments, and then it's gone. He says, in the grand scheme of things, human life is like that. I'm now 51 years old, and it doesn't seem that way. I know I'm getting older, and some days I feel it more than others. But I look back, and it's hard for me to believe that I've lived for half a century. Half a century. That seems like a long time now. You know, I don't think of myself as half a century old just yet. But that's the reality of it. And I've heard from people who are in their 70s saying, boy, 70 years, it's just gone. And I've heard from people, my dad's 90. And he talks about just how quickly things seem to pass. Life is very brief. Life is very uncertain. And even when we make our plans, even when it's necessary to plan ahead, James says it's necessary to plan with an element of humility. Then he also talks about a trusting life. Not only do we need to proceed with the assumption that tomorrow may never come, we also need to proceed with the idea that God is in control of our lives, and as much as possible, we turn things over to him. Obviously, we still have to make decisions. Obviously, we're still the ones who have to do this or that. But we do it in trust of the Lord. So he says in verse 15, instead you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that. By the Lord's will, we exist. By the Lord's will, this earth is sustained. And by the Lord's will, we may have tomorrow or we may not. So whatever we do accomplish, whatever we hope to accomplish, is ultimately done in the light of the will of God. And then in verse 16, he describes, he goes back to this presumptuousness that sometimes characterizes our life. And in verse 16, he says, "But as it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil." Again, the idea that we just assume that tomorrow is there. You know, you might think, well, okay, I need to improve my thinking. But I want you to notice what James says about it. He says, it is arrogance, it is boasting, and it is evil. There's nothing good about that mentality. He says that is a mentality that we need to completely flush out of our minds. That should not characterize our thinking in any way, shape, or form. So to have this presumptuousness about tomorrow, James says, it is a sinful thing. And then finally, there is the wasted life, the wasted opportunities, the example of Thomas Carlyle, the example of us so often. Therefore, to the one who knows the right thing to do and does it not, to him it is sin. Sometimes there's not anything wrong with putting something off until tomorrow, but if there is something important, something critical, we need to act today. Because again, we have no guarantee of tomorrow. In fact, again, he follows up the claim in verse 16 that this kind of thing is arrogant and evil and boasting. He follows it up by saying not only is it arrogant and evil and boasting, it is sin to pass on those opportunities. That's pretty strong language. There are a lot of things that the Bible does not call sin, but when it does label it that, we need to take it seriously. So this kind of presumptuous, arrogant, overconfident attitude that we sometimes have about this life, this certainty that we try to bring to it, and just constantly living in the Scarlett O'Hara zone, well, there's always tomorrow. No, there isn't. We don't know that, and it's presumptuous to live that way. James says that is a sinful kind of mentality. We'll talk a little bit more about these lost opportunities, and I guess sometimes awareness is what we need. I came across this part of this list recently on something I saw by Carrie Weller. Carrie Weller is Gene Weller's daughter-in-law. She had a post on Facebook that made me think about some of this, but at least three things I think on this list I found on hers. I thought it was thought-provoking. First of all, here's an example of a lost opportunity, a kind thought that is not expressed. Frederick William Faber said, "Kind thoughts are rarer than either kind words or deeds. They imply a great deal of thinking about others. This in itself is rare, but they also imply a great deal of thinking about others without the thoughts being criticisms. This is rarer still. A, we should practice the art of having kind thoughts, and B, we should practice the art of taking those kind thoughts and doing something about them," was his point. How often do we think conscientiously, or consciously, I should say, about other people? And how often do we think in positive terms about other people? One of the characteristics of love is how love approaches or how love thinks about other people. If you look at 1 Corinthians 13, in Paul's description of love, Paul's description of love in 1 Corinthians 13, look down at verse 4. "Love is patient, love is kind and is not jealous, love does not brag and is not arrogant, love does not act unbecomingly, it does not seek its own, it is not provoked, it does not take into account wrong suffered, does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things." That particularly there in verse 7, it bears and believes and hopes and endures all things. That means it puts the best possible connotation on things. Also back up in verse 5, it does not take into account a wrong suffered. Some translations say love thinketh no evil, or love does not impute evil. It's the idea that when I perceive someone's actions, I put the best possible connotation on it. That's the beginning of these kind thoughts, is looking at others in a charitable way. And so often we look at others and put the worst possible connotation on that. We see something that could be interpreted in more than one way, and we just automatically assume the worst about them. That's not a good way to treat people. Love says, and kindness says, that we look at it in the best possible way. But we need to take it a step further. We need to take it a step further and do the right thing by it. Whether it's something we say, whether it's something we do, regardless, we need to take these thoughts and express them in the appropriate way. Jesus said in John chapter 13, verse 17, if you know these things, you are blessed if you do them. You are blessed if you do them. So a lost opportunity is a kind thought that is not expressed. And related to that is a kind word that is not spoken. The Old Testament, particularly the book of Proverbs, has just so much to say about our words and what they say about us. Proverbs chapter 15, for instance, Proverbs 15, verse 23, a man has joy in an apt answer, and how delightful is a timely word. There's nothing like a well-timed word from someone. There's nothing like you're having a bad day and someone comes up to you and says, by the way, I'm thinking about you. Doesn't that make your day? Someone comes up to you and says, I've been praying for you. Or the fact that someone even notices that you're having a bad day. You say, well, is everything all right? I don't know about you, but that does me a truckload of good. Just the very idea that someone noticed and then took the effort, the energy, the time just to express that. A wasted opportunity is a kind word not spoken. Also from the book of Proverbs, Proverbs chapter 25, verse 11. This is one of my dad's favorite proverbs. He says, like apples of gold in settings of silver is a word spoken in the right circumstances. A timely word. A word where the thought is expressed in just the right way at just the right time. He says it's like a picture made out of gold and silver. He said that's how beautiful a thing that is. Also again from the book of Proverbs, this time in chapter 12. Proverbs chapter 12, down in verse 25. Anxiety in a man's heart weighs it down, but a good word makes him glad. If you want to take advantage of the opportunities in front of you, learn how to use your speech in a constructive way. Learn how to express those thoughts in words of kindness, words of encouragement, and let somebody know verbally that you're thinking about them, that they are in your hearts and minds and prayers. That can make all the difference in someone's day. Another example is a kind touch not given. I looked up the word touch in the Bible, and it occurs a fair number of times. It's one of those words you don't often think of in a biblical context, but what really struck me was how often the word is used in Mark's gospel. Turn over to Mark for a moment. Just want to read some verses in the gospel of Mark. Mark chapter 3. Verse 10, for he healed many with the result that all those who had afflictions pressed around him in order to touch him. How often was Jesus in a crowd and people just wanted to do nothing more than touch him? There were people who were healed simply by touching Jesus. And a number of these verses talk about people touching Jesus. Chapter 5, verse 28, here's a woman some translations call it an issue of blood. She had a hemorrhagic problem. And verse 28, if I just touch his garment, I will get well. Chapter 6, verse 56, wherever he entered villages or cities or countryside, they were laying the sick in the marketplaces and imploring him that they might touch the fringe of his cloak, and as many as touched it were being cured. And in chapter 8, verse 22, they came to Bethsaida, and they brought to him a blind man and implored Jesus to touch him. In this case, they're asking Jesus to touch him. They understood that Jesus could reach out and touch someone and they would be healed. And then in Mark chapter 10, verse 13, they were bringing children to him so that he might touch them. But the disciples rebuked them for it. Jesus turned around and rebuked them. He said, let the children come to me. Jesus was not at all averse to touching people. Jesus was not not at all averse to putting his hand on their shoulder or putting his arm around their shoulder. Have you ever had somebody do that when you were down? Someone come up and give you a hug, a warm embrace, just let you know what, I'm thinking about you and you're loved. Touch is one of the most valuable senses that we have. It's not only great for making sure that that pot isn't about to scald your hand, but it's also great for more intimate touches. One of the more interesting studies that came out of World War II, in Europe, there were orphanages where literally hundreds of babies were brought because entire cities were bombed, the adults were killed. And one of the more interesting studies that came out of this wartime was the effect of touch on infants. In one particular hospital, they noticed there were a number of infants who were perfectly healthy. I mean, they checked everything they could check. The child had adequate nutrition, and yet some of them did nothing more than constantly cry, and even a few of them, for no apparent reason, died. And they couldn't figure out why, and finally somebody figured out, you know what these babies need? They need to be touched. And so they made it part of the nursing routine to go in and hold the babies and rub their heads and rub their backs and rub their stomachs. And they immediately saw an improvement. Sometimes we need our tummies rubbed, don't we? Or we need our backs rubbed, or we need somebody to put their arm around us. We need someone to put their hand on our shoulder. They need a good handshake. Those are ways that we can appropriately touch one another and express the affection and the love that they need. Don't families hug? Don't families touch one another? If we are the family of God, that ought to be abundantly in evidence. The kind touch not given is a lost opportunity. Kind deed not done. Turn over to Hebrews chapter 13. Hebrews 13 begins with this affirmation, let the love of the brethren continue. Just keep loving each other. And then he goes on to give some specific illustrations. One illustration is in the form of hospitality. Verse 2, do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by this some have entertained angels without knowing it. Hospitality is a kind deed, and we frequently have opportunities to do that. He says in verse 3, remember the prisoners as though in prison with them, and those who are ill-treated, since you yourselves are also in the body. Sometimes a visit to someone who is struggling can make all the difference in the world. Sometimes you can't visit them, but if nothing else, you think about them and you pray about them. That is something that you can do on their behalf. Also down in verse 16, and do not neglect doing good and sharing, for with such sacrifices, God is pleased. One of the things that makes God happy is when we share with others. It is an expression of concern. It's a good deed. It's something that ought to be done. It expresses not only our devotion to God, but it also expresses our devotion to one another. He says, do not neglect doing good and sharing. Doing good. All kinds of ways that you can do good. I don't think you could make a long enough list of good deeds that you could do. All kinds of ways to do it. But when we fail to do those opportunities, when we fail to do these deeds, we're missing out on valid opportunities. There's a lady by the name of Joanne Jones who was a nurse, and she said, here's an interesting story from when she was in school. During my second month of nursing school, our professor gave us a pop quiz. I was a conscientious student and breezed through the questions until I read the last one. It said, what is the name of the woman who cleans the stool? Surely this was some kind of a joke. I'd seen the cleaning woman several times. She was tall, dark haired, in her 50s, but how would I know her name? I handed in my paper, leaving the last question blank. Before class ended, one student asked the teacher if the last question would actually count toward our quiz grade. He said, absolutely. In your careers, you will meet many people. All are significant. They deserve your attention and care, even if all you do is smile and say hello. And the writer said, I've never forgotten that lesson. I also learned that her name was Dorothy. She got it. Sometimes it's a simple deed, like saying hello, making people aware that you care about them. I've seen this many times, and you probably have too. If you've been in a grocery store, at a convenience store, and you look at the teller and it looks like they are about to do something drastic. They are fed up to here with customers and the idea of customer service, and the customers have been serving them up dish after dish of spite and misuse and abuse. And sometimes just saying to them in a very polite way, "I hope you have a good day," that can make all the difference in the world. A kind deed not done is a lost opportunity. But sometimes we're on the receiving end of these kind deeds, and we need to acknowledge that. A kind gesture that is not acknowledged is another lost opportunity. When someone does something good to you, how do you respond? The best example I can think of from the New Testament is in Luke chapter 17. Luke 17 is the story, verses 11 through 19, of some lepers. Jesus was on his way to Jerusalem. He passes between Samaria and Galilee. He entered a village, and 10 leprous men who stood a distance many. And they raised their voices, saying, "Jesus, Master, have mercy on us." When he saw them, he said to them, "Go and show yourselves to the priest." As they were going, they were cleansed. Now one of them, when he saw that he had been healed, turned back, glorifying God with a loud voice, and he fell on his face, giving thanks to him. And he was a Samaritan. And Jesus answered and said, "Were there not 10 cleansed? But the 9, where are they? Was no one found who returned to give glory to God except this foreigner? Stand up and go. Your faith has made you well." All the other people were healed, but only one of them acknowledged it. And only one of them got the point that Jesus was the Messiah, and he did this as an act of God's grace. And in that, he did not miss out on the opportunity to acknowledge the good that was done. I'm thankful that each of us is sometimes on the receiving end of good deeds. And when we are, we ought to have enough humility and gratitude to do something as simple as say thank you. When we fail to do that, we've missed out on these opportunities. And one last thing, turning the Bibles to Titus chapter 3. Titus chapter 3. The greatest opportunity of all is our opportunity to respond to Jesus who died for us. Titus chapter 3, beginning in verse 3, "For we also once were foolish ourselves, disobedient, deceived, enslaved to various lusts and pleasures, spending our life in malice and envy, hateful, hating one another. But when the kindness of our God and Savior and his love for mankind appeared, he saved us not on the basis of deeds which we have done in righteousness, but according to his mercy, by the washing of regeneration and renewing by the Holy Spirit, whom he poured out on us richly through Jesus Christ our Savior, so that being justified by his grace, we would be made heirs according to the hope of life." It is the kindness of God that brings us salvation. It is the kindness of Jesus, his willingness to go to the cross on our behalf, that resulted in our salvation. And the greatest lost opportunity of all is to take the love of Jesus and then just ignore it. To take the love of Jesus, the sacrifice of Jesus, the grace of God demonstrated in his Son, and simply brush it off as if it's unimportant. Whatever we are or whatever we hope to be in this life, it is purely by God's grace. And if we are unwilling to accept that grace, then we are most miserable, we are lost, we remain sinners. And that is the greatest opportunity of all, is to obey Jesus as Lord. Horace Mann said a long time ago, "Lost yesterday, somewhere between sunrise and sunset, 2 golden hours, each set with 60 diamond minutes. No reward is offered when they are gone forever." There are opportunities that we have in front of us every day of life. But the saddest thing of all is when those opportunities come and we fail to seize them. We fail to use them. And once those opportunities are passed, they're gone and we can never reclaim them again. May God help us each and every day, first of all, to look for those opportunities. And second of all, to have the courage and the commitment and the faith to use those opportunities in a way that glorifies God. If we can help you in any way in your spiritual life tonight, we invite you to come forward while we stand and sing.